Emily, so would you introduce our fantastic guest this evening?
Absolutely. Today we're honored to have Wendy Ellertson on the show, a leather sculptor, visual storyteller, and fine craft artist with over 50 years of experience. Thank you for coming to the podcast, Wendy.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Rough.
Absolutely. So, Wendy, you were saying what your favorite part of the Grammys was, and I'm sorry I didn't hear. Would you mind repeating that for us?
Oh, it was watching Tracy Chapman sing Fast Car and remembering Tracy when she was a youngster at Tufts and busking in Cambridge. So it was amazing to see her looking fantastic. And just the fact that that song has lasted all these years is a really wonderful tribute to her. And I love the fact that it was covered by, you know, they sang it together was really awesome.
Luke Combs.
That's right. Yeah.
Oh, I remember seeing that single when I was, I don't know, like middle school-ish. Like it had just reached the smaller parts of Texas. We did not get new music very often, I will admit, even in the 90s. So I remember hearing that and being like, I don't understand this. And now I listen to it and I'm like, I love this.
I'm trying to remember whether we actually saw her at Passim's in Cambridge. We may have gone over and seen her.
Ooh.
Because we were there then, so.
Yes.
That's one thing about art and artists is we all have finite time here to create our art. So when you do something like participate in a concert or buy something from an artist or go and experience something that is art, you are experiencing history to some degree because they can only make so much art. Like, you know, you hear about musical artists having like farewell tours or retirement tours all the time. And like, that's it. If you don't get a chance to see them, you're not going to see them. That's it. Forever. And so I think about that when it comes to like pricing, but also like just don't wait, go experience what you can because you may not have the chance another time.
Well, it also is, I find that people are drawn to pieces, and sometimes, you know, they've loved a piece of an artist for a long time, but they never bought it, and suddenly that artist stops making that, and then they're really upset. And I think you never know. I mean, most artists move on with their work and change and evolve, and that's what excites me about artists. I mean, I'm in awe of people who can do production work and do the same stuff all the time. It's really awesome, but that's not me, and that's not the artist that I actually gravitate most toward. So I remember when I was making leather clothing, I had somebody who, they said their goal was to get one of my outfits, and they came the next show and I had stopped making clothing. And it was like, sorry, you know, so, but you can't wait. Although the concept of retirement as artists, I find very interesting because I don't think there's any, as a singer or a dancer or some other professions, as an artist, you have to retire. But as a artist, sculptor, there's nothing waiting for me pension-wise as an artist to retire. And the whole concept is very strange for me because some people retire from their jobs to do what they want to do. And if you've been doing what you believe in and is you all the time, then why would you retire from it? You know, you might stop going to shows or doing this or that or whatever, but it's a very strange concept, I find.
You're still creating. Yeah.
Well, exactly. You know, and I mean, I'm still doing, you know, still traveling and setting up shows and everything. And who knows for how much longer. I remember one time a friend died just before a major fine craft show in Baltimore. And I knew he was a little older, but I didn't know how old he was. And he died 2 weeks before the show. He was planning on setting up for the show. It turns out he was 90.
Wow.
And I thought, you mean when I'm 90, I'm going to be schlepping around to the show, Stella setting up everything? And I thought, and now I'm thinking, who knows? You know, I'm already 80. So, you know, It's I could see 10 years down the road still. I might need a little bit more help setting up the booth, but other than that.
If you want to, why not?
Yeah.
Right, exactly.
Well,
Yeah.
and I love the perspective that you have on that of like, that is not an obstacle for you. It's like, I'm going to continue doing that, and that's part of my journey to continue developing as an artist and then continuing to look at what is the next thing? What is the next thing that I'm going to work towards? So it's less an obstacle and more of a goal.
Well, and it's interesting. I think you sort of evolve. I mean, I think that I'm always fascinated to see what's going to show up next, because the way I work is sort of not with a lot of specific goal setting, but sort of being willing to let the work go where it wants to go. I mean, that's sort of the way I make stuff too. I start something and then am willing to let it go where it wants to go. And so it's exciting to see that, and I think that that's what's really fun. I was actually looking at a quote by Martha Graham today, and she was talking about how artists are never satisfied. They said that's because there's this queer divine dissatisfaction, a blessed unrest that keeps us marching and makes us more alive. I think that's sort of a cool concept. It is that, you make a piece, you're pleased with it, but you never feel it's perfect, because if it was perfect, you'd stop making stuff if you created the perfect thing, So it's an interesting ongoing process, the creative process.
We've talked before how Emily and I have talked before where we look at a project and we go, I could just like fix this like one thing about it. And then it kind of, it's that like one step devolving into madness. And at work, a friend of mine said, done is better than perfect. Get it to the
Well,
point that
exactly.
it's meeting the need and then stop. Otherwise, you're going to continue to pick at it and refine it until it's not the thing that you wanted to make.
Well, and you have to let go at some point. You have to take a faith to sort of say enough is enough. I do a lot of beading and a lot of elaborate work on some of my creatures, and the question is, when is it done? When is it enough? Enough is enough, and when do you go over the over? So that it's that's too much, that threshold of what is too much and what is, I mean, it's a funny threshold, because sometimes it's hard to say when too much is too much, but I think that it's that process of letting go, of saying, I personally feel like when I finish a piece that it's not mine anymore, it belongs to somebody else, and my job is to put it out there. People say, how can you sell them? Well, because you love your children, but you want them to go off and have their own lives. And so it's with art, I see it's the same way. Isabel Allende, I once heard a quote. She said that when she writes a book, she considers it a hand reaching out. And until somebody's
Oh.
picked up that book and read it, the process is not complete. And I sort of feel the same way,
Wow.
that it's putting it out, it's putting that energy out in the world, that it's what it's about.
That's so romantic too, from a romanticism standpoint, that it's not yours anymore. It's like your gift to the world to
Yeah.
some
Well,
degree. Yeah.
I feel very much that part of our job of artists is keeping that creative energy swirling that's out there. I don't think it gets lost. I think when we lose artists and lose creative people, that energy is somewhere. And your job as the artists who are still here is to tap into it and let it out. And I think the older you get as an artist, the more you know it's not about you. It's about something else. And it's letting yourself just let that out, be it, I don't care whether it's music or acting or anything else. It's like it's important to keep that creative energy swirling.
There's a book that Emily and I bought by Felicia Day, and it's one of those let your creativity just kind of fly. I'm forgetting the name of it, and it's sitting over on my craft table right now because I was doing one of the prompts in it. But she, in her book, says a lot of the same things of whether or not someone sees your creativity is unimportant. The fact is getting it out of you and getting it out onto whatever medium that you're working on, be it fabric, painting, leather sculpting, what have you. The point is to get it out and to let it be seen by, if no one else, yourself.
Yeah, I
I don't
mean,
think, yeah.
well, it sounds like
Well,
you.
yes. Yeah.
So
Go
sorry.
ahead.
Go, no, go ahead.
Oh. Go ahead, Emily.
It sounds like you kind of already create for yourself. The fact that you kind of see where it goes and have that approach to it. Would you say that's correct?
I don't know that I'd put it that way.
Okay.
I think that it's not, I don't know whether you feel impelled to create and to use your hands and create. I think it's the way we make sense of the world by using our hands as artists who do physical stuff. And that it somehow helps, sort things out. So it's not so much, maybe it's a method of somehow making sense in the world, or feeling that you're offering the world something. And sometimes you don't know. I mean, it's this balance of what is it you're offering or not offering, or and you can sit around trying to judge it and try to figure it all out, or you can just do it. And I'm much more of the spirit of you just do it, and hope it's something pot. I mean, I do think that objects have power. And at one point, I was making stuff that objects that pulled some energy toward me that I had a lot of reservations about, at this one show. And I thought, Wendy, you better think about what you're putting out there, because I like playing with black leather and the dark. I mean, I think shadow is as important as light in the balance of things, but I don't like to go over to the dark side. And I feel like there's enough negative in the world that I don't really want to put it out there. And so I had some pieces for a while that I was making that I felt like the energy was just too negative. And so I stopped doing them. I had liked them, but I just stopped doing them until a couple years later, when I was still intrigued with the forms, and I realized by reconfiguring it in a different way, I could give it a different type of energy.
That's kind of awesome, though. When you first started, though, you were working on, like, did you started with clothing,
Clay. No, I started
clay,
with pottery.
clay.
I started with
Sorry.
pottery. I mean, I have the long path here. I started with pottery, and I'd always loved clay. I'd always loved making figures. And my first art trade was a few small figures made out of what was called Pyrocon then, which is like Fimo today. And a trade for an artist, a friend, painter friend, who gave me a little painting that I still have in my studio, actually. And then I started working with clay. I had the blessing of being trained as a potter by Toshiku Takiezu, the amazing potter. That was before I went to college. It was at Cleveland Art Institute. One summer, I did an intensive with her. She even gave us all her glazes, her glaze formulas. So I used her. I still have her formulas. I used to use them for a long time, and the ash ones in particular, because certain types of ash will produce really interesting colors. So apple ash, you can get a really nice reddish brown, and elm with some copper in it can make a beautiful green and stuff. And so I did. So I was with clay, and then and production potting for a while. But even my production potting had some sort of story aspects to it. Like, I would make a teapot, but the trunk was an elephant's trunk, and there was a mouse on top of the trunk. And so, and I also realized that to be a really good production potter, you have to throw all the time really consistently. And I was raising small children, and that was
Yeah.
not really feasible. So it was, so what do you do with that? You focus on, well, what do you have to offer? and the funky other stuff that I did, I thought, okay, all the potters aren't particularly doing that. And then I got intrigued with doing doll making. Barbara Newman, Johansson Newman at Rhinebeck, and Lenore Davis were this wonderful textile artists who did figures, et cetera. I was sort of intrigued with that, so I started making figures, and did that for a while, then did soft sculpture. So I was working with velvet dragons with porcelain heads. And then I was taking a workshop with Lenore Davis. This was in the 70s. And I was already doing a lot of dragons and sort of mythic creatures, et cetera. And Lenore, it was a Procyon dyed velveting workshop. And first of all, I think she realized I wasn't really a painter, because I'm very much a three-dimensional person. And she said, Wendy, have you thought about leather? And I thought, no. And so I started thinking about leather and started learning about leather. And there's a real affinity between leather and clay, because when you talk about leather hard clay, it's because it works like leather, you know. So I learned about wet forming and sculpting and all sorts of stuff with leather. So then I started working with leather, and I really like, well, I'm drawn to tactile materials, clay, leather, beading, old textiles. It's all, it's, if it doesn't feel good to work with, I'm not interested in working with it, basically. You know, and then I had this whole sort of saga with leather. And a friend sent me, well, I should backtrack again. One of our kids had a number of surgeries when she was growing up. And so after another big surgery, I would sort of decide, okay, I've got to do something slightly different, you know, and for some reason, change it up. And a friend said, go to the Museum of Fine Arts and look at this one piece there, Wendy. I think you'll like it. And it was a 1400 BC loincloth with pierced leather. And
Wow.
it was a great, great testimony to the durability of leather. This is from 1400 BC. I was trying to figure out whether they had cut out little pieces of it. Turns out they had. There was a template, which I didn't know at the time, but I thought, but you don't need to cut out any part of it. You can just slit it and then open up designs. And so that was why I ended up doing a whole line of leather clothing and accessories. And the ones on the Facebook page are the, you know, white leather wedding veil, why not? And other costuming and stuff. And so for 10 plus years, I was in the whole fashion and costuming world. First of all, sort of just scarves and ruanas and stuff. And then it got more structured as I worked with people in costume shops who really knew how to pattern cut and this and that. So that was, it was a fun 10 years. And it was also when my brother was around doing costuming. So it was fun to play off him and stuff. But then I started having trouble actually with my hands because I was doing thousands and thousands of slits on leather, little tiny one patterns, et cetera, on glass. So there was no drag, but still it was that repetitive action. I had some people working for me too, but it was still, I thought, you know, this is, I can't do this forever. I mean, speaking of things you have to retire from. So I sort of decided to stop doing that. The last part I did of that was that for Anna Sui one season, I worked for her. My leather supplier connected me with her, and she wanted to do some pierced leather clothing. And I said, I can pierce it. So she sent me the clothing all cut out and that stuff. And all I did was pierce it, which is the best money I'd ever made because it was like just my labor. And it was a skill that I'd figured out how to do, you know, and I was really fast at it. So that was fine. And then she went off and did something else, which I expected. So it was, you know. So now I do sometimes the leather for the figures and stuff. But then I thought, I've done all these different things. And I thought, but what seems to be consistent? The figures seem to be pretty consistent through it. So I've sort of stayed with aspects of leather, although leathers have gotten more creature and stuff. So, you know, it's been a journey.
But
Done dragons. What?
I was just going to say, but I love that journey. It's you had said it before, and I'm just going to echo what you said, that artists don't have one, they don't stay in a silo, they branch out and they do so many different things. And I love that your creativity took you from one thing all the way up to where you are now. That's such a journey, but it also look at how much you created, like even the stuff that's behind you. That's
You know,
It's beautiful.
No, well, it's fun seeing, as I said, what shows up too, I think, because I used to do, as I said, the dragons used to have clay heads and claws, and then they switched to wood heads. There's a whole story about stump critters, that a stump in our yard and the stump that need, yeah, there's a lot of storylines between a lot of the species that I've developed. And then stories, and then I've been working on sort of trying to figure out, okay, what stories show up? And I connected with the Mythic Imagination Institute. Do you guys know them?
No, but I want to.
Well, yes, they're not as active as they used to be, but there was in 2006, 2004 and 2006, they had this program called Mythic Journeys, which was basically a gathering of all these amazing people. And I was lucky enough to go in 2006. And it was storytellers and philosophers and arts for the new humanities and singers. I mean, it was everybody all coming together, the Brian and Wendy Froud and Toby
Oh,
Froud
yeah.
and a ton of writers. And so we got to not all know each other, who'd all sort of been in this realm together. The theory behind it was that if you get all these really creative people together, the world can change.
Is it Mythic Imagination Institute?
Institute, yeah,
Okay.
it's mythic imagination.org is the website now.
Okay, because I'm seeing that there are two. All right, I'm going to
Yeah,
post the other one in the
they did
chat.
two mythic journeys, and then they did then a couple of years after they did the last one, they ran a course in New York City that I thought, you know, Wendy, it's about time to spend some money for yourself instead of just on the family. And so I took this course, which was a turned out to be a year and a half long course. Every other month, we would get together for very long, intense weekends in New York City. And it was the weekend, we would be together 24/7. There were about 10 to 12 of us in the class, and spend all weekend long with Michael Mead or with Diane Wilkinson, David Gonzalez, Ari Burke. I mean, there's a different focus. Michael, you know, it was amazing. And I thought, well, it was called you'd get a certificate in applied mythology. And I thought, so maybe that'll help me figure out what I do, you know, why I do what I do and everything. And so I took the whole course, deciding I still don't know at the end of the course if I understood what I did any better, but I sure had a fantastic time and got to know some really amazing people. And discovered all the mythic themes and stories that were really behind my work that I never really knew about before, and some of the stories that I was writing at that time too. So it was an interesting experience, and I have stayed in touch with a lot of those people too, which is really amazing.
When
Part of
you,
them was all.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Was going to say the other people who were connected with this too were Ellen Kushner and Delia Sherman. Became sort of part of the group too, and that's how evolved into the Interstitial Arts Foundation that they formed, that I was on the board for a while when it was going. And it was really fun because it was that whole idea that all of we artists who live in the sort of interstitial spaces. I loved the way Ellen used to talk about it, I think, was that if you think of a house with all its different rooms, you know, you've got the biography room and you've got the this room and you've got the that room, but then you have the halls and that's where the parties take place. And you've got all these people interacting in all these halls, and that's the interstitial world that we live in. You know, so it was a fun time period. Then it became so common that you didn't really need it anymore. You know, people, organizations outlive their need. So it sort of moved on, and we all did. So,
Did you get to meet the Frouds then?
no, with Brian and Wendy and Toby. I mean, when at Mythic Journeys, my memory of Toby was when he was like a 6-foot-tall satyr at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
But then it's been interesting watching him and realizing, I mean, I knew that the knew the Froude's work, because when I was initially doing figures, I remember seeing drawings by Brian and Wendy before The Dark Crystal, and but already thinking of emphasizing features and faces, etc., and also that threshold between grotesque but humor. And so my work evolved in the direction of people see sort of similarities with their work. I mean, my
Sure.
kids at one point said, "What are you guys doing running around up there in the Dark Crystal, Mom?" You know, and it's my stuff was distinctly different, but it's part of that same whole world. So it's been fun watching Toby move and evolve with his own company and having the Stripey Pajamas company that he had, because he was in the Stripey Pajamas in the David Bowie movie.
What a
And
perfect
then
name,
working
huh?
exactly well, and then moving on, he was working for Henson Group and stuff, and he was involved in the Pinocchio, the new Pinocchio movie too. So it's, you know, it's fun watching paths.
Yeah. When you are creating your pieces in that world, are you telling your own story? Like, are these all characters in the same world, or are they all very individual for you?
They're all, well, sometimes there's species which show up. Like I did a whole series of stump critters, which were based because their snouts were out of the stump from our front yard. And so there was a whole story legend behind the origin of the stump critters. So in that case, there was sort of a commonality. And I also did a whole series of traveling librarians, thinking of all the ways that books could arrive. They could have arrive on dragon back, on via Pegasus and a canoe. So our daughter was running a and her husband a program in Ecuador, because they were living down there. He's from Ecuador, and there are no public libraries in Ecuador, and so they were bringing books to the schools in the mountains, in the Cuenca region, and so they helped support the program. I would make these traveling librarians, and I would get the money from the traveling librarians to help with the program. So it was really fun thinking of all the different ways they could show up, and wrote some poems about traveling librarians. Other times, I don't know who the creature is until it's done, and then sometimes I don't even know. And now, sometimes I'll put pictures up on Facebook and say, "Okay, people have ideas for the name of this person." Or this figure. And
Neat.
I have a last few years a very special relationship with this wonderful visual artist, storyteller, amazing artist in Arizona named Beth Surdut, who for some reason we're not neither one of us are sure why, but I send her images of my work and she immediately knows a backstory and spills out the whole legend. She doesn't know why, and if she doesn't have to think about it, it just comes out. So it's, you know, it's fun. I mean, I think my focus at this point is to sort of help stir up story and creativity. There's the South African storyteller named, I don't exactly know how to pronounce her name, but Jacina Melope has.
Okay.
Says she, I've got a quote, she tells stories to wake up the stories in others.
Ooh, I love that.
And I love that comment. A friend of ours went and saw her recently in South Africa. And I think that's my work now, I feel like, is about stirring up stories and creativity. So I sort of start a story, but then people, I want them to take it where they want to take it, or add to it, or I've been making some scenes, story sculpture sort of scenes where you need to, it's asking you to transport yourself into that space, and then maybe add to it and think what's going on in that space and the story that comes out of it. So I've been
Fascinating
talking, like,
answer.
any other questions?
No.
Have you ever considered compiling these stories into a book? I mean, you mentioned the storyteller from Arizona, but have you thought about putting these sculptures together with the stories and kind of making it into a book?
Well, I've written one book, which was that was a story that evolved. I was walking around our neighborhood, and I saw this wonderful cupola at the top of this Victorian house, and I thought, gee, I wonder what lives in that cupola. Maybe there's a nest up there. Maybe a large nest. And so the story started spinning itself out. I did not know that my creatures would show up in the story, but of course they did. It ended up being this sort of chapter book for family bedtime reading, which my grandkids would come in town and they would ask me, so what happens next? Every time they came, there'd be another chapter sort of coming along. And it ended up being the story of this young storyteller named Sophia, who was asked by the world to figure out what happened to the phoenix. The phoenix appeared to have disappeared from this world or perhaps all worlds. And so her job was to go on this quest to try to figure out what happened. And so in the process, some of my creatures showed up in her story, and she ended up doing research in a flying book library. I make a lot of dragon books, which have wings behind their pages, etc. And so, of course, in this library, all the books are on perches instead of shelves, and they fly down to be next to a perch so she can look through them as she's learning about them.
I
And
love that.
I learned a lot about some of them are easier than others, she points out. Some of them are a little fluttery, and she has to be quieter with them. And myself, I did a lot of research about phoenixes, realizing that one of the reasons I love myth is because of the similarity of images and stories across cultures. And a great many cultures have a phoenix-type bird, just as a great many cultures have dragons, or other stories which keep getting repeated. And it fascinates me how they, it's the same story, just slightly differently told. And so, so in that case, so I don't know, Trey, as far as the other stories, the other stories I just sort of put out, I think, other than the legend of the origin of the species that sort of stay there. And I've written a couple of the little books, like the native rock of Massachusetts is pudding stone. And there's a lot of pudding stone in our neighborhood. And so I was looking at the stone and thinking, there's got to be a story behind the word pudding stone. And a whole species of pudding stone creatures came up. And of course, those needed a book and a story behind them. So, yes, there was a story about that. So, I never quite know when it's going to, when they're going to show up. The Sophia's Quest was the longest one that I ever did that took me a long time to write because the story spun itself out in part around the time that I was taking that course in New York. And I realized how many themes that I had put in the story that I had no, didn't realize they were so related to so many mythic, general mythic themes. But then I had to actually edit and think about writing, doing some decent writing of it. And so I had some help along those lines. And then I had to find an illustrator because I don't draw. I'm trying to do more drawing, but basically I'm not two dimensional. And so I went to one of the sci-fi fantasy cons I do sometimes, Aresia in Boston. And I asked a friend that I knew through the Interstitial Arts Foundation to come and sit with me because she was an illustrator. And so I could figure out what would be a fair price for an illustrator. And so as we were sitting down to coffee, she says, wait a minute. I had passed the manuscript around to some friends for feedback. And she said, I have a painting in the show that I made after I read your story. And she hadn't connected the two until then. So we went down and looked at it and thought, yes, that's the cover of the book. And so that became, and then I gave her the choice of which I wanted like three or five illustrations inside. I didn't want a lot of illustrations because I wanted people to use their imagination. But at the same time, kids like some nudges of illustrations. And so I asked for like three, and she said, but there were five scenes she really wanted to illustrate. So, five black and white illustrations came up. Actually, she made them in color, and then they turned in black and white for the printing, but now in the Amazon Kindle version, they're all, the color ones are there too. So it's, it was really, I love collaboration when it works that way. Because it wasn't, I wasn't telling her which ones to do or how to do it. I just wanted to see what came out of her in response to the story. And what came out was awesome.
That is so cool. I love when that type of collaboration happens.
Well, I think collaboration in general is, I was thinking earlier today as far as just generally how I work. And I also thought about, I was raised with a lot of jazz. My parents love jazz. And number of times I've looked at the parallels of how I work and the connection sort of with jazz. I mean, I love to go to live improvisational jazz concerts. And what I love about it is that everybody's sort of doing their own thing, but they really have to listen to what other people are doing around them. And you've got basic skills that you're working on or a theme or et cetera, but then you take it where it seems to want to go, and every performance ends up being different because of the energy of that particular concert, and so that's sort of, I look at the materials that I use and play with and try to understand and listen to and stuff, and then what comes out of it is always different, and I don't. Even when I'm making book covers, I put pieces of bark and wood on, down, and the leather's molded over it, and I begin to visualize it with the wood, but I don't really know what it's going to look like until it's finished. And that's also a case where you have to sort of just let it go where it wants to go. So it's, it is that sense of improv.
That sense of improv. That is so cool.
One thing that I am kind of curious about, because I read it somewhere, I hear that you have a fascination with gargoyles. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Well, I think that has something to do with when I was in college, I lived in France for about 6 months and got fascinated by gargoyles. On all the cathedrals and all the buildings, et cetera, and then in other cities in New York and stuff. And I think it, I'm drawn to things that are, I'm not particularly drawn to sweet and pretty things. That's not my thing. I like edgier stuff. But as I said, not going over to the dark side, but sort of, and gargoyles are wonderful that way because they're all these, interesting creatures. And also, perhaps it's because they're not literally anything either. The reason I love dragons is dragons can be anything. Gargoyles are creatures, but they're not like, okay, this is a cat. This is, I mean, some gargoyles are, I guess, but generally speaking, there's a lot of imagination in the their faces and what they are, and they're a little scary, which is sort of cool. So it's just a, as I said,
Sometimes for me, sometimes they can get a little goofy, which is why I appreciate like different interpretations of them, that they can span that range of scary but also a little goofy. My boyfriend and I just went up to the Biltmore estate. And thanks to sulfur erosion and those sort of, I'm sorry, acidic erosion and those sorts of things, the once probably immaculate gargoyles, now some of their faces kind of wiped away a little bit, but in doing so, it's also exaggerated some of the faces. And so what were like these beady little eyes have become these like gigantic insect eyes on the sides of these walls. And so what once was like really scary is now just like meh.
I was gonna
Well,
No, go ahead.
but yeah, no, I think that's wonderful. It's like I do think, I mean, I do think that I don't see gargoyles particularly, I mean, a little edgy, but not scary. not horror. It is that threshold between edgy and horror and pretty amusing. I mean, grotesque but funny. It's like Brian Froud stuff. It's like it's and other artists. It's that grotesque but with a sense of humor.
Yeah. Yes.
And it's interesting what people see in it too, because like sometimes people will I make book covers with one eye usually in the center of it, and I do it for all sorts of reasons, but some people are really put off by them, and other people really they get that they're really pretty humorous, or that they connect with it. And so I think it's always fascinating to watch people respond. I actually like people to respond to art because I feel like people should react to it, and they don't have to like it, but they should react to it, and it should elicit something. If it's sort of like, oh, that's nice, it's like, that doesn't do it for me. You want to make something that's
Yep.
helps people.
Like Tom Paradise said, art should provoke.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Something, anyway. So, what kind of feedback do you get then from your pieces? Probably all kinds, right?
All kinds. I mean, some people, well, you can see people come by. It's why I like in-person shows. I mean, rather than just putting it out there on the internet or selling to galleries, which I do, but COVID was really hard because you couldn't be around anybody. And it's not so much, I think, that I need people to say, oh, how wonderful you are. It's like, I just like that interaction. And lately, I mean, like the last show I did, what really pleased me is I saw people who came by the booth who spent a little time in the booth physically relax and breathe.
Wow.
And I feel like, and smile maybe, but it's, and I feel like if I can offer that right now in today's world, that's really important. And it doesn't have to be anything more major than that. But that you're trying to let people step into a moment. The other thing I think art can do is give people that sense. I mean, Marcus Borg talks about in Celtic mythology talks about thin places
Yeah.
where the spiritual and the physical worlds, the veil thins out. Or, you can look at it from a religious standpoint, but you can also look at it as a that is what art does. If in the presence of music, an awesome aria or theater performance or a painting that you don't know why you're drawn to, but for some reason you are, it's because that veil has stretched thinly. And you need those moments to cope with everything else in life, I think. I think you need to be able to sense that. You can call it awe or whatever else, but and I think more than ever right now, you need that.
I agree. I often say that words fail me during conversations, but the thing where I feel the most seen, or the thing that I feel gives me that sense of catharsis, is theater, or is some type of art. I was working on some pieces behind me, if you can see them in our live chat, the doublet that I've got over here. And even just getting that out, even in its somewhat unfinished state, has been one of the most cathartic things to work on. Albeit some very choice words to my sewing machine as it decided to like break needles and stuff.
Well, because as you've discussed on the other podcasts, it's like it's work. I mean, doing art is work. There's a lot of it just doesn't happen instantly, or magically. It happens through doing the work. And part of that can be somewhat meditative or very frustrating, depending upon whether the needles break or something that are like, I I do mostly hand stitching. I have a very, the only machine that I use, sewing machine now, is this little 1920s Singer that will go through anything. It's a very tiny, compact one. It was for quilting in the past,
Awesome.
because I like doing hand stitching and like doing hand beading, and I was sort of knew how to do this sewing machine stuff, but I didn't have the tech. I didn't have the technique, for instance, that my brother had and everybody else. And it was really important to me that the stitching be really well done. I mean, I love looking at people who make leather bags who are really, really good stitchers and who do an excellent job and stuff. And that's just not the way I work.
You know, Trey, maybe your broken needles on the sewing machine are just your sewing machine's way of making art of its own.
Yes, art that, you know what, you're right, because art should provoke, and it does provoke me to anger and fits of violence.
That's great.
Well, it's funny too. It's like, I don't know, it's like, the whole fashion world, or I think one of the reasons I also sort of left that world a little bit was that I felt like having my brother around, who's a costume designer and excellent sewer, et cetera, he felt that the things inside should look as nice as the outside. Even if it was a costume that wasn't going to be worn for very long, it just had to be well made
Finished,
and durable,
yes.
et cetera. Yeah. And for a while in the fashion world is about the price point and about the look, not so much how it was done. Now, coming from the craft world, it's how it's done. For a while, it was more how it was done, not so much even how it looked. I mean, if like there was a lot of clothing there for some years, which looked beautiful, but didn't really work on the body. So the people who, put them on, there was more like on the walls. And so it's that, how do you blend all of that? I mean, for me, when I was doing clothing, it was a little bit like bringing wings to people's back, down to people. I mean, I have this thing for wings and flight in general in a lot of my work,
Ooh, me too.
which I can talk about. And it was about having people feel good about their bodies and how they moved in their bodies, how their bodies moved, because none of the piercings showed unless you were moving, or not entirely. You could see some of it, but yeah, that's the other thing. Flying and flight is really crucial to my work. I used to think it was, let's backtrack. I used to fly a lot in my dreams when I was a kid. And if I would get in trouble in a dream and I was being chased by somebody and there'd be a window there, I think, oh, wait a minute, I can fly out the windows. That's not a problem. So it was my easy escapist route was flying. And I used to think it was just a sense of escapism and flying. And then the more I thought about it, and as it stayed with me all these years, I realized it's not about escape, it's about perspective. That I've spent a lot of time in children's hospital and AIDS wards and other places. We live in the inner city. I've been to too many funerals. If you're flying above, you get perspective on the bigger picture, and you don't worry about the little stuff that really doesn't matter too much. I mean, you spend much time in an AIDS ward or children's hospital or whatever, it cuts to the chase really fast. And so it's, how do you keep that sense of perspective over what really matters, and see the bigger picture too? See that borders aren't as important, or all that sort of stuff. So I've always done flying things.
Fascinating.
The only thing is, I was also doing my creatures. I used to talk about them flying, and I realized that when I fly in my dreams, I don't have wings. So why should
Yeah.
my creatures could certainly fly without wings. They didn't need wings to do that.
Mean, that's kind of how we visually know that they can. But that doesn't mean they need to.
No, I think, man, when I did this whole species of star wanderers who flew a lot, the whole storyline behind them was that, really wings get in the way when you're flying around, So, although now I'm doing more wings with some, I'm doing more bird creatures, et cetera, which have a lot of wings, because I do like wings. I think wings are cool.
So, I do have one question before we move on for that. So for the creatures without wings, narratively, what is your reason for them not having wings, and what makes them fly?
That could be science.
Well, it's because all my creatures fly, you know. So it's like, because it's like they just do. I don't know why or how. I don't know scientifically how they possibly do it, but they also all have tails, and that's becomes useful because you can hang all sorts of interesting things off their tails, but also makes them stand up easily too. And I don't know. It's just there's something about flight. I think part of it's being able to move through time and space too. When Sophia moves from one time period or space period in the book, she flies into the sea of eternal depth and swims down and suddenly ends up being in another time and place. And I think as a kid, I was in the water a lot, and I think my sensation when I'm flying, when I'm dreaming, is the same weightlessness as you when you're swimming. So I'm curious whether people who were raised in water fly more in their dreams. And being in airplanes a fair amount, so looking out on the clouds and stuff and visualizing yourself on the clouds.
Well, I'll contribute to this because I also flew a lot in my dreams as a child, but I did not grow up near water. I did take swimming lessons, but I didn't wasn't really near the water other than that. So I
Do you
don't know.
still fly in your dreams?
Sometime, not as often. I don't like that answer.
Now the quest becomes, how do we make Emily fly in her dreams?
I'll let you
Well,
know if I do.
I used to feel like I don't fly as much as I used to, but every once in a while I will, and I'll realize there's something. If things are good, then suddenly I can fly. You know, there's more flying going on, so
That could be
it's interesting.
true.
I'm not sure what jars it that direction.
There's a few messages in the chat I want to read because they're pretty great. A lot of people liked your from various Twitch and Facebook and stuff liked the improv with Jazz. As far as the stitching goes, Kaz said, Kaz in our chat also does some leather work, and or a lot of leather work. I'll let Kaz say that. But Kaz said, "Oof, don't look at my stitching then," because we were talking about stitching. And she said, "Hence why I strive to make all my leather pieces be built together with rivets." And then Josh said, "Can we keep Wendy, please?" And Lisa thought maybe the reason they could fly was it was just it's in their DNA.
That's probably true. Yeah.
But yeah, we want to keep you, Wendy. Oh, and Kaz also said, I'm sorry, Kaz said that she grew up basically in water and she flew all the time. And she lost her ability to fly in dreams when she lost her heart horse.
Aww.
Oh.
So maybe something will bring back the flying. You know, I am interested in, and also some people fly, they hover very low when they're flying in their dreams. And some people are, sorry, I'm not interested in, I mean, I'm always up. I have this relationship too with birds and hawks in general. And I used to, when I would drive to shows, have to be very careful because a hawk would swoop down in front of the car, and I'd have to be careful not to just let myself go with that hawk and make sure I was on the road, you
Wow.
know. So, but it's, and now in the mornings, what I do is we have a new space in our attic, and there's a bay of windows up there, and I go up there every morning, and look out and do a little Tai Chi and sort of greet the morning. But I also don't leave until I've seen some birds that are usually flying high. They're not, you know, there's some trees up there. And so it's fun to greet the birds in the mornings. But again, it's the flying birds. It's not so much the, sitting ones.
Yeah. Do you put food out for the birds?
No. Well, actually, that's not true. My husband puts seeds on our front steps, actually. But we don't really have any bird feeders. There's a lot of, although we have so many plants and stuff and things that they're birds don't have a hard time finding
Sure.
stuff. We also have coyotes and wild turkeys and all sorts of creatures. Nothing like living in the inner city in today's world.
And having coyotes and turkeys.
And possums. Well, when we were growing up, the kids, we had rabbits and chickens, and we used to have chicken, banty chickens that would roost in the trees.
Oh.
I mean, our kids were raised in the city, in the inner city, sort of thinking they lived in a farm. That's my husband was raised in a farm, and so there's sort of we've always grown vegetables and plants, and we have community gardens now and stuff. So we feel very lucky actually, because we moved out into the neighborhood when it was very, very inexpensive. And it's made all the difference to be have a roof over our head and stuff.
Yeah. I like to throw peanuts out for the crows. And since our episode with Brenna, almost 2 years ago now, where she it told us all about how to attract crows, so I started throwing peanuts out at least every other morning. It depends. I usually throw them out the night before because the crows get up way before I do. I can hear them out there. Sometimes they wake me up. But we'll get crows now, and they'll actually come up closer to the house now and right under the deck. And we're every I don't know, every season I'm one step closer to making friends with them. It's a slow process, though.
You've already made friends with chipmunks, so crows is logically the next step.
Truly. Eventually I'll have one on the podcast. It'll just be like here on my shoulder.
Right. Well, this friend of mine, Beth in Arizona, has all sorts of relationships with birds that she is. I mean, she calls herself listening to the raven. And so I've done some raven books too. I like trying to figure out what the essence is of a bird or a creature so that you can read, have a sense of what that is, but it's sort of not literally anything, sort of do ish type things. But the wonderful children's book called Ish,
Heard of it. I haven't read it though.
well, I really like it because the basic idea behind it is that this one of the children, I forget whether the boy or the girl, is drawing, and somebody makes fun of his drawings, and so he throws them all out. And his younger sister, I think, takes them all out of the trash and puts them all over her wall. And he comes in and he's appalled. He says, "But that doesn't look like a flower, this or that." And she says, "But it looks flower-ish. It looks dog-ish. It looks obviously." And so, that's what I love of it. And then at the end of the book, if I remember correctly, he's sitting there just in an ish state for a little while, which I also really like. So it's my favorite book for art teachers at school. I had some unfortunate experiences with art teachers when I was growing up. So it's like letting, more freedom happen and,
I love that. Yeah. Like Diego, the doodling dinosaur.
Right, exactly. The purple crayon or the,
Oh,
it's like,
yeah.
yeah.
Yeah, it is kind of. I
Ever.
see the resemblance to the purple crayon.
Yeah.
That is fabulous.
I don't
The other
know.
good book that I like is, do you know the old book called Everybody Knows What a Dragon Looks Like?
No.
It's why I like doing dragons too, because I used to try to do little animals, and I think, well, people said it doesn't look like this or like that, and I thought, well, too bad. But dragons, nobody can say that about. And the basic story of the dragon book is that this city is about to be invaded by this marauding horde. And so the emperor calls up the dragon to protect the city. And suddenly an old man comes up to the gate of the city And the young man who's there was helping sweep, sees him, and he says, "I want to see the emperor." And he says, "Well, he's really busy right now because he's trying to call the dragon, etc." And he says, "I know, that's why I'm here." And so he comes and talks. So he lets him in, talks to the emperor, and emperor, of course, has this idea of what a dragon should look like. And his counselors have a sense of what a dragon should look like, and all the rest of the people, and dismiss him. And so he goes back to the gate, and the boy at the gate off shares his bowl of rice with him. And the gentleman turns around and says, "Because of you, I will save the city, not because of the emperor." And of course, then he transforms into this, huge dragon, etc. But it's fun. I like things that can be looked at lots of different ways. So,
I like that you are whimsical in that way.
yeah, whimsy is, well, the whole fantasy and imagination world has always been really, important to me. And I think it's, it's not that I'm not, I mean, I think my work is interesting in that I'm, on the one hand, very grounded and rooted in the city and all sorts of issues. And yet there's this other aspect of me too that's sort of not. And it's an interesting combination of how does that blend and how does it come out? And for whatever reason, it seems to be me, it's like I've always done whatever little niche in this really sort of world. It's like, not fitting in a little box art-wise. Or when I got a master's thesis in French, I wrote on African theater in French. Let's see what little tiny niche of the French market you can, and I think that's always been, I've always been these little tiny little, the work I do now is this little niche of work, so it's and at some point you accept that that's who you are, mainstream, whatever. The other thing I've thought a lot about is I wonder how many artists feel a little bit like they're looking in at the world, rather than being of the world. And I've thought a lot about how I actually think that that's maybe most artists do. It's being part of the peer group or part of the popular kids or something of the sort has never exactly been the desire of most artists. Maybe having a friendly cat with you is important, but
It is to him right now. This is Oliver.
I never read much as a kid, which is funny because everybody assumes I've read all these books. I started reading books in response to everybody assuming I knew all this literature. I mean, I was making dragons of all sorts of different colors way before I read Anne McCaffrey's books about different colored dragons. And so it shows my favorite thing used to be books that you think I would like, or you ought to assume that I've read, which I probably haven't. And so now I've slowly but surely you're catching up with, a lot of the classic literature and all sorts of realms because I really didn't read. I don't know why I didn't read much. I didn't really learn to like to read until I was about a sophomore in high school. And I had this one teacher who connected with me, and she gave me this book, which is a slightly bizarre book, but for some reason I really related to it. It was about this dwarf who was sort of always looking at and stuff. So it's, it's also small, and I'm small, so I don't know whether that was part of it. But it's interesting. I think to live a life as an artist, I think there is a certain amount of separation that happens, maybe, or I don't know. What do you think, Trey? You were saying you could relate to that whole idea.
For a lot of my life, I've felt like a narrator, like I didn't quite have my own story to tell. And it wasn't really until I hit college that someone flipped the narrative and said, "You spend so much time telling other people's story. What's yours?" And giving voice to something we were talking earlier in the podcast about getting the ideas out of your head. And I have spent so much of my life not talking about myself and really wanting to talk about other people that I started being a little bit selfish in the way that I said, this is how I think of things. And when I started speaking out and saying what was actually running through my mind, it started to shade other people's perspective and give them that perspective that it sounds like you already have. So it's been nice to find that balance between, yes, having that perspective of things, but also being able to go, and here's where I'm just going to leave my mark right here, and then just kind of back away and watch what happens.
Well, I think one of the things that's interesting as you get older is to go back and think, what's the thread that's pulled you through life? Is to try to go back and look and think, wait a minute, you think you're this person who changes or grows up or whatever, et cetera. But in fact, if you go way back, I think most people have this thread that's pulling them through. And the trick is, what is, I mean, and it's fascinating to sort of go back and look at that, whether you're writing or looking back at your own life or look at the work that you did and think, what's the commonality in it? I've done a lot of different things, but what's the thread that seems to be going through there? I'm curious to go over to Ireland, actually, because I have a lot of Irish heritage. My great grandmother, I think, came over to the United States in around 1840 by herself at age 15 as a seamstress. And not entirely sure that's true, but it's a good story, and I like the story part of it.
We'll
So,
stick with that then.
I'd like to know more, but I'll stick with that. But I'm just I for a long time. Well, first of all, my kids sort of denied their Irish heritage. They were more interested in my husband's Norwegian heritage, in part because we live in an inner city Black community, and you don't necessarily lift up your Irish heritage considering South Boston's history of Irish, et cetera. So there wasn't a lot of talk about it. But the more I've thought of it lately is to think, okay, if you stop and think about the Celtic and you look what I do, I make these small creatures, there's all these myths and this and that, and you think there's nothing to do with your, Irish heritage here. So I'm very curious to go over and just see, not so much visit graveyards and find out names of the places, it's just to see if there's any resonance that I feel. Because my guess is, I mean, my dad was a great storyteller and there's other things, but I'm just curious.
Yeah, I am too now.
Normally, geographically, I'm more connected to the Pacific Ocean and to redwoods and to mountains that are real mountains, like in the east here. And so the geography per se of Ireland isn't something that entirely intrigues me, but I'm just curious, sort of. What I asked for my birthday was that we renew our passports, so at least we have the possibility of travel.
Yeah.
Yes.
Good.
So Wendy, I want to make sure before we end the podcast, I have two final questions for you. One, what can we look forward to upcoming from you, or what are you working on now?
Right now, I'm actually working on some large bird creatures, and I'm also working on this whole sort of environments or dwelling type situations on my website. Now there's a sort of a tent type that's sort of, it's called Ocean of Possibilities. It was made in part because I couldn't go to the Pacific Ocean last summer, and so I was creating a space that would I could transport myself to from that standpoint. But I am intrigued with creating these environments which encourage people to transport themselves into, whether they're portals or whether they're just, so that's the whole direction I'm still going. I made a large tribute dwelling during COVID, which was trying to figure out how to hold the stories of everybody we lost, and not just from COVID, but from all the other things that were going on during those years, and wrote. It's filled with books with names and a little bit about the people and strings of beads, trying to figure out how not to be overwhelmed by the loss, but to how to think about each person. and think about each person as a story. So there's an opening in the front of it so people could go in, and then there are two doors in the back, because the whole idea is that there's a storyteller in the center, is that the stories could come and then pass on and continue on. And so I that's what started doing the whole thing. So I'm not entirely sure. It's my work's getting a little bit more meditative from that standpoint. And I don't know what new creatures are going to show up. I thought I was going to make some, I've done some frogs and lizards recently, and I thought I was going to make more frogs and even a turtle, and then these birds showed up. That is what sometimes happens, and I just have to let it happen.
It'll be interesting to see how after a trip to Ireland, your art will be impacted.
Right, exactly. That's why I like travel for all of that reason, you know.
And if you would like to donate to Wendy's funds, you can email us. please sponsor us. We love you at themodrom.com. or if anyone would like to donate their lottery winnings, we're more than welcome to accept.
Right, exactly. Right. I could easily use lottery money lots of different ways. Of course, that means I would have to play the lottery, which I don't, but that's another thing.
That's, kind of the gateway to it.
Wendy, the last question I have for you tonight is, if there was an artist that was looking to dive into art for the first time, or get into leather sculpture, or really anything creative, what advice would you have for them?
I think a couple things. One, I really encourage people to figure out what materials they're drawn to. Or two-dimensional or three-dimensional. I mean, I find some people are sort of oriented one way or the other, but I find that it's like, as I said, I need the tactile, I need the clay and the leather and the beads. Some people don't need that at all. It's all about design. And so it's sort of helping yourself understand what makes you excited from that standpoint. Mm-hmm. And then also to play with materials. I've done some workshops with families where I did a clay workshop and they said, well, what are we going to make? And I said, well, that's up to you. You know, here are the materials. There's clay, there's tools, there's some stones and this and that and stuff. See what comes out of it. A story will come out of it. I can guarantee it. And they always do. But, you know, it's not being afraid to play and not being afraid to try. Mm-hmm. You know, it's so whether you're sewing or working with leather, or you don't know until you've played with the materials whether that resonates with you. And I think the other thing is that in today's world, I mean, we were really blessed because we had really inexpensive housing and could survive all these years. I could survive as an artist. That's harder in today's world. But if there's something that you're passionate about or you're really intrigued with, it's important to keep that as part of your life with all the other stuff you've got to do too, is figure out how to have it in there, you know, and you might even be able to figure out how to make a life out of that. So I would say play, not be afraid to play and to fail, because that's part of reason art is fun, is because, you know, failure is not failure. It's just a learning experience. Being willing to take risks in life, because life is, who knows how long it is. I've never presumed. I feel like every day you wake up vertical is a really blessed day, you know, and you might have 100 years, you might have 6 months. It's the journey that is, for me, is what you really should savor along the way. So I don't know whether that answers your question, Trey.
No, it 100% does. And for me, this hour speaking to you is all about perspective. You talked about with your dreams, how you've realized that the flying is less about the escape and more about the perspective. So I feel like this whole hour, I've gained a new perspective on things. And I really appreciate that. So I have to say, thank you so much for being on here. If nothing else for me, I got a lot out of this.
Oh, thank you very much.
I did too. Yeah.
Wendy, we would love to hear about your trip to Ireland. I know I would love to have you back.
Yeah.
After I'll come back after the trip to Ireland. That means we've got to go. So it's like,
Please,
yes, talk to my husband. No, we've got it. We definitely need to go. So
This, yeah, this is.
we've been lucky to travel lots of places because our kids have lived different environments and stuff. So we spend time, around and about and stuff, which is and I find travel is very, it always is fascinating to see what comes out of it.
Well, that's I agree with Lisa in our chat. She said, that's your homework, Ireland. And we've been so fortunate to have you on the show today. Thank you so much. You are, as Josh put it, you're a treasure. And it was such a thrill to be able to have a peek into your world today.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. And thank you for all the people that you're bringing out to the world. I really appreciate that you've got, I love your word in interviewing imaginatives. I love that term. Makers, I'm not as partial to. I mean, I like the term artists, but I think imaginatives is a really nice way to, nice name for all the different people that you've brought on, because it's been a fascinating group of people. It's awesome.
Thank
So
you.
keep up the good work, you two.
Thank you so much.
Well, as we close this episode out tonight, this episode, along with every other episode, is dedicated to Joe Capone, our moderator, fellow comedian, passionate encourager, and greatly missed friend. You can find us pretty much wherever you tune into podcasts. For announcements, updates, and more, please follow us on social media under Modern Romantic and tune in to Wendy's social media pages so that you can see her updates about her trip to Ireland. Thank you, everybody, and I hope today you get some perspective.
Thank you, everyone. Good night.
Bye. Good night.